This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Whether it's famine, war, or natural disaster, and no proper existing medical facilities, you're likely to find the group Doctors Without Borders caring for the sick and wounded. Volunteer doctors have served in Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Africa, Romania, and Southeast Asia. Over the past 20 years, Doctors Without Borders has become the world's largest independent emergency medical aid association. It was founded in 1971 in France, where the group is known as Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF. My guest, Dr. Ronnie Brauman, is the president of the group and has participated in nearly all their missions since he joined in 1978. He was just in Philadelphia to accept the Philadelphia Liberty Medal in recognition of the group's contributions to freedom and equality. The Red Cross has a code that prevents its medical workers from discussing the politics behind the wars and famines in the countries where they work. MSF was formed by doctors who had worked in the Biafran War and who wanted to speak out about how the Nigerian government had blockaded relief supplies to thousands of starving people. But Dr. Brauman says when he first heard of MSF, he wasn't sure it was an organization he'd want to join.
When MSF was created in 1971, I was a medical student. I was in my third year of medical studies. And in fact, I didn't like Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders at all, because I was a leftist radical at that time. And I thought that, all the solutions were political, and that bringing relief, humanitarian aid, was just bringing illusion to the people. And I decided that I would try something with Médecins Sans Frontières, just because it was doing something in the third world, and I wanted to know what the third world was like. You know, we thought that the revolution would come from the third world, and that many things would come from the third world. So I decided to join Médecins Sans Frontières to be on the field, to be in the third world, and in order, of course, to change the third world, to achieve, you know, revolutionary goals. And in fact, the third world and my experience changed me. And I decided that, I didn't know what sort of political project I was supposed to bring to those people, but I had many things to bring to them from my profession, from my human approach, and I had many things to learn from them, just because they were what they were, their culture, their situations, were highly, extremely interesting. And on the more balanced and realistic exchange, I changed my mind and I continued.
So did you become less of a revolutionary after actually witnessing the results of revolutions in the third world?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Why was that?
Well, you know, the first terrible experience was the Khmer Rouge experience in Cambodia, when we discovered what it was all about. I mean, when we discovered all those mass massacres, frightening social surgery which was performed in this country, we realized what revolution could be when it was radicalized to that extent. And then, the boat people from Vietnam, and then, Poland, and then, what was happening in the eastern countries showed us that even when it was not that radicalized, the social effects and the liberties were absolutely tragic. So I just gave up.
You gave up on revolution, but not on helping people.
Not on helping, not on social goals, not on solidarity spirit. I think that all this is important. From this period of my life, I still have in mind that, solidarity, sharing are very important values, and I still believe in them.
Tell me what it's been like for you to learn how to perform surgery under conditions that would be considered unsanitary and unsafe in the West.
Well, first, you operate on patients who will die if you don't operate on them. The indications of surgery are much tougher in these conditions due to lack of antisepsy, to the lack of medicines. But I had a real good theater, surgical table, good surgical boxes, and I could do a rather good job. The problem is that I was both anesthesiologist and surgeon, because I had no anesthetics, of course. So that complicated the work quite a deal. And, the way you can get reassured on your work is that, well, you know that if you don't operate on this patient, he will just die. But another problem raises now. And the problem is that when you operate in emergency on such a patient, very often it's an emergency you're not prepared to deal with. Why? Just because a patient who would come to the hospital to be operated on with, for instance, an acute abdominal syndrome, peritonitis or something like that, would be operated on straight away in a normal hospital. Now, when he comes to you, you say, okay, I'm going to treat you, you got to be operated on. Then he says, or his relatives say, we accept the idea, but we've got to go back to the village and ask the family council to give his opinion on this proposal. So that may take another 3, 4, 5 days. And you just can't do anything before the village and the family have made a meeting, gave their opinion, and handed over to you. This is absolutely forbidden, even if the patient dies. This is very, very tough. I mean, on a psychological, on a deontological way, it's extremely difficult for us to accept that. It took me a number of weeks to accept it, but I did it. And then, when you operate, of course, a peritonitis after 5, 6, 7 days is extremely difficult to operate on. So, well, that changes a bit the techniques of intervention, and that complicates still more the problem. But, well, you have to do with that, and you learn a lot from that.
Yeah. My guest is Dr. Ronnie Brauman, who's the president of Doctors Without Borders, an emergency medical aid organization which provides relief to victims of disasters, wars, and famines around the world. Were you in the Middle East during the Gulf War?
Yes, I was in Turkey and Iraq just about 6 weeks ago.
And what were you specifically doing there? What was the nature of your mission?
Well, first of all, bringing emergency medical relief to the Kurds fleeing from Iraq towards Turkey and Iran. So we had a very large team there. At one stage, we had more than 150 doctors, nurses, logistic officers, because everything was extremely complicated. The climate, it was, the late winter, it was still very cold. The geography, you know, it's in high mountains. Politics, because as you know, neither the Turks nor the Iranians were cheerfully welcoming those refugees, at first stage at least. And we found it very difficult to set up, all our tent hospitals and dispensaries in those conditions. So it was a real tough job, but extremely useful, because we lost time at the beginning of the crisis. But then, after a couple of weeks, it became possible to work at top speed. And we worked night and day, and I think we helped and saved many, many people.
What were the typical medical problems you were seeing when you were in Turkey or northern Iraq?
The main problems were diarrhea and respiratory infections, but severe ones, which claimed many, many lives. Many, many lives. And most of the children who died from respiratory or diarrheal infections.
What do you do to protect yourself when you're exposed to things like this?
Nothing. Nothing. It's useless. It's useless. Those people get infected because they are very weak, the lack of, basic hygiene. We are not that weak, and we have the basic hygiene, so it's all right for us. We need nothing, except, of course, when we work in a cholera camp. Cholera camp is an isolated area where you set up tents tents where we just follow-up tents, then intensive care tents, then recovery tents. Three kinds of different tents. And this has to be very, very firmly isolated. There is a small bath where you have to step in order to disinfect your shoes. there is you have to spray your the soles of your shoes and sometimes your jacket or your clothes in order not to spread the infection throughout the camp. That's the main thing. But I mean, we hardly had any case of cholera in our own teams. We had only two, and we've treated probably over the past 2 years, we've treated more than 30,000 cases of cholera.
Did you have any doctors who were in Iraq during the war while Iraq was being bombed?
No, it was forbidden. We tried to get into Iraq, but we were not given the permission.
By the Iraqi government?
By the Iraqi government, yes.
Are you often turned down by governments?
Not often, and I would say less and less. But on the early 80s, I think we have to say the word, because I mean that's the reality. When communism was still at its peak, some countries were quite difficult to enter. I'm talking about Cambodia, Afghanistan, Angola. These kind of countries where you had to be pro-government to be admitted in the country. And we were not pro-government. We were not anti-government either. I mean, as I told you, we were non-political. But being non-political in those conditions meant, to the eyes of the political leaders of those countries, be anti-government. So we were not accepted.
Dr. Brauman, let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Dr. Ronnie Brauman, who's president of Doctors Without Borders. It's an emergency medical aid organization which provides relief to victims of disasters and wars and famines around the world. It's a French-based organization, and in France it's known by the title of Médecins Sans Frontières. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Ronnie Brauman is my guest, the president of Doctors Without Borders. Have you personally ever been under attack or threatened by forces who didn't respect your role as doctor?
Oh, yes, several times, yes.
Can you give me an example of one of those times and how you handled it?
I was working in Chad with a surgical team. I was the team leader because I'd been working on the field for 3-4 years. And we had a break and went to wash in the river, in the Shari River, which makes the border between Chad and Cameroon. And there was no water in town. There was absolutely nothing. So we had to go to the river to wash ourselves and have some water to boil and drink then. And we were caught under heavy fire by a group of unidentified people who turned out to be the opponents of the group with which we were working. And they had sent a commando of about 20 people to kill us. And it was an absolute miracle that we were not killed. I mean, the surgeon, unfortunately, was severely injured. He got 2 bullets. I was a bit further on with the anesthesiologist. And we were just in the river, trying to dive, to be underwater, to escape from the bullets. And we had the impression that it was raining, you know, that heavy drops were falling in the water, and that lasted about 4 to 5 minutes, and all of a sudden it stopped for a reason which is not clear to my eyes up to now, and that allowed us to take the surgeon and take him to another hospital in Cameroon, where he was operated on by the French army, which was there. And we went back to Chad, and another surgeon joined us, and we resumed the work, and we paid more attention to security measures.
Did the surgeon survive?
Yes, he survived. He's okay now. Now he's in New Caledonia.
So he's still doing this kind of work?
Well, he did it again. No, he's working, I mean, as a hospital surgeon in New Caledonia, but he did other missions afterwards.
Can you share with us a recent experience that you had that you just found profoundly moving?
I would say that the two last trips on the field were profoundly moving. One was in Turkey, where I saw what was happening in those refugee camps, and the situation was absolutely dreadful, horrible. But I think that most of our listeners know it because they've seen it on their TV screens, and I think they've been moved as much as I have. The other situation, which is almost as appalling, is in Mozambique in southern Africa. In this country, which doesn't bring a lot of media attention, doesn't bring much of public opinion or political attention, there is an old war which is going on. And this war, in the aftermath of the war, there is a large-scale famine. When I say large-scale famine, I should precise that, in fact, thousands of people are touched by the famine, are concerned by the famine, but in pouches, you know, in small areas where you can find, for instance, 10, 15, 20,000 people who are just starving to death because they just can't reach their own field. They have been forcibly relocated and almost condemned to death by starvation because, well, the logic of war is going on, and the militaries, whether guerrilla or official, again, doesn't make much difference. The militaries are waging war, and the civilian population is suffering, and is suffering to an extent which is really difficult to imagine. I'll give you an example. I was in a small village, which is called Lugela, right in the center of Mozambique. In this village, which has normally about 500 to 600 inhabitants, 18,000 people were forcibly taken, this time by the government forces. 18,000 people. After 3 months, 5,000 of them had died from starvation and cholera. 5,000 of them. That means that almost one-third of the people of this population had died in less than 3 months. That gives you an idea of the tragedy. And I think, and I'd like to seize the opportunity of talking to you and here in the States, I'd like to raise to some extent public attention on what's happening in Mozambique. There is an urgent need for media attention, for public opinion attention, and for emergency aid in this country. If there is public attention, if there is political attention, and if there is more aid, it will be easier to reach those who need to be reached, those people who are isolated and forcibly relocated, and we will be able to save them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Ronnie Brauman. He's president of Doctors Without Borders, which is an emergency medical aid organization which provides relief to victims of disasters, wars, and famines around the world. Do you still find, in spite of all the years that you've been doing this kind of medical relief work, do you still find that there are medical problems and wounds that you are just unprepared for?
When I was in Sri Lanka recently, I saw a young girl. You were talking about moving situation. That was another moving situation, to see a child who is wounded. This is probably you just can't get used to that. Never. This poor child, it was an 11 years girl, had got several shrapnels on her left shoulder. And, the shoulder was just blown off. And, there was nothing much we could do for her. And that was absolutely horrible. But I doubt that we could have done something really more efficient in Paris or New York, because there was no more shoulder anyway.
When you come back from the field, back to your home in Paris, does Western medicine seem any different to you? High-tech medicine, the things that we can afford, those of us who are lucky enough to be able to afford it or have health insurance.
Yes. I must say that sometimes, yes. First of all, I think that sometimes the doctors, and probably the patient, this is probably the whole society, everybody seems to forget that, there is an end to our lives, and death and disease seem to become a real scandal in our societies, and that surprises me. I think that disease has to be treated, but disease is not a scandal. Disease is part of the life, and death death is part of the life. I mean, death is the normal. there wouldn't be any life if there was no death. And I am surprised to see that it seems to be more and more unacceptable in our societies. And I think that this has a very bad influence on the medical techniques, on the medical corps, because it sounds like we should have doctors to look after all the everything we do, the way we eat, the way we move, the way we drive, the way we sleep, and I think this is quite insane, and that this is more and more surprising for me.
I guess it must be odd for you to go from one situation where thousands of people are dying from famine to another situation where incredibly heroic measures and expensive measures are used to save one person's life.
Yeah, well, I think that this is also, I mean, part of the honor of developed societies. I think that to spend a lot of money, a lot of energy to save one life is not questionable in one sense. My question is rather about, well, the way we would like to medicalize all the aspects of our lives.
Do you ever worry that having been exposed to as much tragedy as you have, that your heart will be hardened to it?
Yes and no. I mean, you have to protect yourself. I've been doing this kind of job for about 15 years. And honestly, if I had the same reactions today as those I had 15 years ago, I just would be depressed. I mean, I just couldn't carry on. But to protect yourself doesn't mean that you become indifferent. I told you, there is one thing you can never be used to, you can never get used to. It's the suffering, the suffering of a child. And unfortunately, this is the main problem, this is the main situation we are faced with. And against this, I am not, and I don't want, in fact, to be protected.
Dr. Brauman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Dr. Ronnie Brauman is the president of Doctors Without Borders. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.